In this part of the show, this hour of focus, we will look back to the first organized bioterror attack in American history. This happened back in the fall of 2001 when a person or persons unknown sent a series of letters through the mail containing anthrax. 5 people died, a number of people became ill, and there are a number of yet unanswered questions about what happened. The big question perhaps is who is responsible for it, but there are others that have to do with the way that public health officials and government responded to this. And again, a big question that still hangs is how well prepared are we now if such a thing should happen today? Would we be able to do a better job in dealing with it than we did the last time around? This morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking with Leonard Cole. He is adjunct professor of political science at Rutgers University, which is in Newark, New Jersey. He teaches science and public policy there. He's an expert on bioterrorism. He's written 4 number of publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the International Herald Tribune, Scientific American, and The Sciences, and also has appeared frequently on both network and public television. He's a regular on MSNBC. He's the author of a number of books, including one that deals with this subject. It's titled The Anthrax Letters, A Medical Detective Story, and it's published by the Joseph Henry Press, and it is out now if you want to take a look at it. You can certainly seek it out in the bookstore. Questions and comments, of course, here on the program are welcome, too. All you have to do to be part of the conversation is to call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Cole, hello.
Hi. Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And yourself?
Fine, thanks.
Good. Thanks very much for giving us your time.
Sure.
I appreciate it. I think probably, certainly people will remember this story, but that maybe it would be a good idea at the beginning to sketch out the basics once again. Obviously, what people will remember is that there was a great deal of concern when this happened back in the fall of 2001, when a number of letters were sent through the mail, arrived various places, one in Florida, some in Washington, D.C., some in New York City, and as a result, a number of people got sick, some people died, and there was a great deal of concern about just how far this thing had spread and could spread. And it all began, or at least the first case we became aware of, was this man who had worked for the Sun newspaper in Boca Raton, Florida. He was a picture editor of the paper. His name was Bob Stevens, and he apparently contracted anthrax by breathing it in as the result of of a letter that was sent to this newspaper.
Right. Well, you know, it's very interesting the way you put it, which is quite the way most people do now. Mm-hmm. This happened some time back, and it's a little bit obscure in our memory. But the interesting thing about this is that the incident started occurring, or at least started becoming visible to the public just a couple of weeks after September 11th. You know, September 11th is embedded in everybody's mind and in our psyche. We remember this fiery fury caught on television and the crashing of the World Trade Center towers. And yet, most people have a kind of, as I say, a fuzzier recollection of what happened with the anthrax. There may or may not be a tie-in between the two. There, at some level, there definitely was a tie-in because there were 4 letters that eventually were recovered that had been sent, and they contained anthrax, and they all contained threats, and they all were dated 9/11. That doesn't mean that they were sent on 9/11, but they referred to 9/11. So there was clearly a connection by whoever sent them, whether it was a person who was a copycat and just kind of jumped on the bandwagon to frighten people more, or whether whoever sent them had a real connection to the hijackers, that is, by way of an Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda tie. Mm. So what happened, as I say, is that with the horrible fury of September 11th was begun and finished in a matter of a couple of hours. The anthrax letters rolled out for a couple of months. The first diagnosed case was on October 4th. But in fact, the postmark on the first two letters that were recovered was September 18th, just exactly 1 week after the Trade Center and the Pentagon bombings, or I should say jetliner bombing. And then the final case that was diagnosed happened to be in the same day that woman died was November 21st. So as I say, it rolled out for a couple of months. And during those weeks between October 4th and November 21st, there was a great deal of anxiety, some of it not even clear to the general public about how worried our national public health people were. The lack of clarity about how many letters were sent, where they were directed, how many people had become ill, how many people might yet still become ill. It was a fright indeed. And I should start with the very bad news right out front. There were probably only six or seven letters that we estimate that were sent altogether. And yet these few letters, a handful the amount of powder that was sent, anthrax quantity, was probably less than a half a bottle of aspirin tablets, and it paralyzed much of the country.
Let me just go here to the big question about who it was that's responsible. If you read the coverage of this, it would lead you to believe that while the government says they're not formally saying that they have any particular suspects and that there might be a number of people that they were interested in, it's pretty clear that their interest was focused on one individual, and that while again they're not saying that this man is a suspect, the amount of attention that they have devoted to him would seem to suggest that he is in fact their number one suspect. Now, going back to the question that you raise, and at the time that this happened, a lot of people were saying, well, does this have anything, is there any connection between the terrorist attacks on Washington and on the world and on New York on September 11th and this? And it seems at this point that, at least in everything that I've read, that has generally been dismissed.
Yeah, that's correct. The initial sense, coming so soon after September 11th, was that even out of Washington there was worry that there was a connection, not just by calendar, but by intent. That is, that whoever sent out the letters somehow knew about September 11th in advance. But that was quickly put aside, and on November 9th, even before the final anthrax case was diagnosed and the woman died, on November 9th, the FBI put out on its website who the likely perpetrator was. Now, they didn't mention any names, but they gave a profile, and the description was probably a male lone scientist, or at least somebody with scientific knowledge who might have had access to anthrax in a U.S. laboratory, a lone misfit, in other words. And then they later acknowledged that they developed the profile in large measure that reflected the Unabomber profile, Ted Kaczynski, who had been apprehended and found guilty just a couple of years earlier. What the basis of all of this jumping in rather prematurely, in my judgment, was is not altogether clear. There was evidence by way of the letters themselves that maybe these were not written truly by a Muslim figure or somebody who pretended to be a Muslim, because the last couple of words of the letters that were recovered were on the order of death to America, death to Israel, and then Allah is great. So clearly someone was trying to suggest, whoever sent the letters, that there was an Islamic connection. Whether that was a real connection or not is still out. But you're right. The FBI has focused on the likelihood of a single perpetrator, and they ended up never using the word suspect, but the Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, about a year and a half ago, said that a person named Stephen Hatfill, who did fit that profile to a large extent, that is a lone scientist and individual, although he did have friends, he was not seen as a total misfit, but a quirky kind of guy, but he was named as, quote, a person of interest by by Attorney General John Ashcroft. Since then, this guy, Hatfill, has been sitting alone. He's not been able to find work. He's under surveillance by the FBI, but no charges have been brought, and they've explicitly said that he is not, quote, a suspect, although they don't deny that he's a person of interest, whatever that means.
Hmm. What do you think about whatever available evidence there is from all, and obviously you've thought about this a lot and looked at what is out there in the public domain. What do you think about the evidence that might suggest that this man had something to do with it?
Well, to be perfectly honest, I can't say that he did not have something to do with this. I have talked to many people. I was unable to get to interview him, but in my book, The Anthrax Letters, I spend a chapter on who did it, and really, I think I've explored the whole question as well and perhaps better than anybody else who's written about it, because I've talked to people who advocate for both sides of the question, that is, that it was a loner, a misfit, and then on the other hand, that it would have been somebody connected to some overseas group or country, including possibly a scientist from Iraq. So I really explored it very, very carefully. And my own sense coming out of all of this is that while it could be any of these possibilities, there just seems to be more, as I call them, dots that would suggest a real connection to the people who did September 11th than has generally been acknowledged. And so I, in a sense, tended to overcompensate, and I don't take quite as seriously, or I don't spend as much time now, after having written the book, looking at the possibility of the individual lone misfit, and more at the possibility of an overseas connection. And we have a little time, I guess, on this show, and I would be happy to explore what I say are these several dots. I can't connect them and say definitely this was an Al-Qaeda operation, but I can say that there is at least enough suggestive evidence that it's premature and still is inappropriate to narrow this down to one or another alternative. On balance, I have a doubt that Stephen Hatfill is the culprit, and I can give you some reasons for that as well.
All right. Well, I have a caller here, someone who's on a cell phone, so I want to get right to them, and we can explore some of these, the very last two areas that you just opened up. And let me also very quickly, for people who might have just tuned in, introduce our guest. We're talking with Leonard Cole. He is adjunct professor of political science at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey. He teaches science and public policy there and is an expert on bioterrorism. And he's the author of the book, The Anthrax Letters, A Medical Detective Story. It's published by Joseph Henry Press, about the anthrax scare of fall of 2001. We'll get this caller here. Been waiting patiently. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Did they ever explore the possibility of a political connection? Did the letters go to one political leaning or another? Was there perhaps a corporate connection?
I missed what you just said before. Did the letters go through a possible what?
Did you explore the possibility that the letters were targeted to a political?
Okay, sure.
Or corporate?
Right. Okay. Here's the way the letters went. There were four letters recovered. Two of them were postmarked September 18th. The first two letters that were recovered, one of them went to Tom Brokaw at NBC News. The other was sent to the New York Post. The other two letters that were recovered each went to one Senator Daschle, who was then the majority leader of the Senate, and the other to Senator Pat Leahy, who was Judiciary Committee chairman at that time. The Democrats had a majority in the Senate, and so both of those senators, who are Democrats, were leaders in that party. There has been thought, presented by some, that perhaps if this were an individual, he would have right-wing leanings, because after all, he sent to the media, he sent to Democratic senators. But in truth, the very first victim, which we heard about a little earlier, was a person who worked for a tabloid newspaper called The Sun, a rather obscure tabloid, small in circulation relative to some of the other tabloids, like the more famous, say, National Enquirer. There are no political leanings that I'm aware of that come out of the tabloids. They were all owned by a large company called American Media Incorporated. Another of the letters, the one to the New York Post, clearly went to a right-wing or a conservative-leaning newspaper. So that would undermine, to some extent, the thought that there were one, that the targets were either liberal or in any fashion, one direction or another.
It was the tabloid a division of a Murdoch company, perhaps?
No.
Oh.
It was owned. It's owned by, to the best of my knowledge, a non-politically leaning consortium. The owner, one of the owners, who was also the publisher and CEO, is a man named David Pecker. I have no idea what his political leanings are. The tabloids came out, and in truth, they would blast anybody and everybody. And they did some very serious, let's just say, they did a number on Osama bin Laden during the months before the anthrax letters were sent, some of the tabloids. So that it's very hard to say that there was a leaning politically by way of who was targeted.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Sure. So that at least partly offers an explanation. One could understand how or why someone might target the Congress. They might target a very large media institution like NBC. They might target the New York Times or a large newspaper. But the Sun just doesn't seem quite to fit.
Right. Well, here's a possible fit. And again, I'm not saying, I want to be very careful because I've already been asked, so why do you think that Al-Qaeda did it? And I don't necessarily think they do, but I think that it's important that we understand whatever is out there and for public knowledge, then we can make our own connections if we wish to.
Mm-hmm.
But here, six of the 19 hijackers lived in the Boca Raton, Florida area during the months before September 11th. Boca Raton is the town in which American Media Headquarters building was located, and that was the first building that turned out to be contaminated with anthrax, and that, of course, has, among others, the Sun had its offices there. So this rather obscure newspaper is down there. Why would it have received one of the letters? I can't answer that, but here are some interesting further dots. Two of the hijackers who lived down there were shown their homes by a real estate agent named Gloria Irish. Gloria Irish took these people, two of them, around. Marwan El-Shehi was one of them. He was the guy that was the pilot for going into the World Trade Center Tower number 2. She hadn't the faintest idea, of course, that they were terrorists, but rather that they were Arab gentlemen, as she put it to me, who told her that they were just trying to update their pilot's license, so they were taking pilot flying lessons. And both of them found their apartments that she showed them through her. Her husband is the editor-in-chief of The Sun. And when I said, well, did you ever mention your husband's name to them, or that he works for The Sun? She said, no, she never had occasion to mention that, to the best of her recollection. Later in my conversation with her, she said, when they mentioned to her that they had pilot's licenses, she says, oh, my husband Mike has a license, too. So I said, well, then, Gloria, you did talk about your husband at least to some extent. She said, well, I did mention that, but I don't remember, and I don't think I said anything about the connection to the Sun. Well, maybe so, maybe not. But she wasn't absolutely sure. Still, maybe it was a coincidence, but you get some more interesting coincidences. Another is that in June of the year 2001, one of the hijackers, later turned out to be a hijacker, visited a Miami hospital, and he had a black lesion on his leg. Wasn't sure what it was. The doctor who saw him wasn't sure what the lesion was either. Saw him that one time, prescribed some antibiotics, and never saw this person again. Then after September 11th, and then after the October anthrax incidents, this doctor had second thoughts. This emergency room doctor, his name was Chris Tsonis, looked at the record again of this hijacker that he had seen back in June and said, my goodness, he says, this fits all the description of what cutaneous or skin anthrax would be like. He wasn't sure. He reported this to authorities. Eventually, two Johns Hopkins medical doctors looked at the records. They had never taken, Dr. Tsonis had never taken a specimen, so he couldn't prove by way of laboratory tests what had been seen. But in retrospect, the two physicians, having looked at the records of Dr. Tsonis, said it is entirely plausible that Dr. Tsonis did see a case of skin anthrax. Now, you have to realize that skin anthrax and inhalation anthrax are extremely rare. The odds of this really being skin anthrax and not being associated with some of the activities later on in October would have been just about zero. But we don't know if it was really anthrax that the doctor saw. It's just that, again, some have felt in the medical community that this was a plausible explanation for what that black lesion was.
Well, I think one of the things that we know about this is anthrax is that it's very difficult to, if you work with it, if you handle it, it's very difficult to keep it contained.
Yes.
If indeed these men had some contact with anthrax, or perhaps they had some, or were somehow involved in at least sending this one letter that went to the Sun, you would think that the place that they lived, likely, you could find anthrax there. Has anyone gone looking for the places where they knew that these men had lived, and to see if, in fact, they could find any?
Yes, you make a very good point there. If a person is working with anthrax, wherever that location might be or might have been, surely there would be evidence of anthrax, unless this was in an airtight laboratory, such as we have in the U.S., there could well have been a spillover effect. To the best of my knowledge, the best of my knowledge is I'm not sure how quickly the FBI was able to find and do the swab tests and find all of the locations that any of the hijackers or certainly people who worked with the hijackers could have been. We don't even know who all the people were in the cell or cells of Al-Qaeda that worked with the hijackers. We have to start with the supposition or the likelihood that the 19 hijackers were certainly not the sum total of the Al-Qaeda people who were in the U.S. There well could be more even now here who had helped develop those plans for September 11th.
And of course, the letters that went to the Senate and to NBC, we believe that those letters were sent from New Jersey.
So somehow
somebody else would most likely have to have been involved in some. At least I guess that's the thinking, that somewhere there around the place where they were mailed would have had to have been involved.
Here are some interesting sidebars as well that would fit in. We do know as well that several hijackers, and therefore presumably people who assisted the hijackers and worked with them, lived in New Jersey, not just those who we know of lived in Florida. So there's a New Jersey possibility. And we know for sure that the four letters that were recovered were mailed in the Princeton-Trenton area of New Jersey, because all four letters were postmarked and stamped with Trenton, New Jersey, which is the postmark of a large sorting facility and distribution facility in Hamilton Township, New Jersey. So the four letters went through there, and ultimately that post office was found to have been fully contaminated. And I shouldn't say post office. It's much larger than a post office. It's a huge sorting facility the size of a couple of football fields. Then an even larger one of this sort eventually was found to have been contaminated down in Washington, D.C. But again, going back to the possibility of the connection to the September 11th people, there is no hard evidence to point in either direction, as far as I'm concerned, to the extent of the knowledge that is out there. But you know, people have said, so why couldn't we have found this processed material spent that would have been spilled over into some other location? There are a range of possibilities, including the possibility that the material was processed overseas and sent over in a small glass vial. And the truth is, February of this year, Secretary of State Powell was at the Security Council, and this is just in the run-up before the Iraqi invasion, and he held up before the members of the Security Council, the United Nations Security Council, a vial of powder. It was a glass vial containing powder, and he said, in this vial, a teaspoon of anthrax powder was enough to close down the Senate. So by showing that and demonstrating how small and confined and easily concealed this powder could have been, he demonstrated how it could have been perhaps brought in from an overseas source. I'm not saying that it surely was, but it would have been very easy to conceal this. And remember that thousands of former Soviet scientists and technicians have been working on the Soviet program. There's a lot of knowledge out there about how to process this material. So it's all possible, and that it could have been brought in and then not found in any location in the U.S. Furthermore, we have other people who, even if it were a loner working in the U.S., we have to ask the question, where would he have processed it? Why haven't we found some spillover and some contamination elsewhere where he or they or she would have been working on it in the U.S.?
Yeah.
We just don't know.
I guess that, and it was my understanding, and do correct me if I'm wrong, that the strain of anthrax was identified to be one that was developed in the United States, and that's one of the reasons that that made one suspect that the person who had done this might indeed be an American, someone who had been involved in the defense complex doing research on this, and someone who would be in a position to have access to this particular strain. And I think it was the Ames strain.
Correct.
That was developed here, and we know that there are places here in the United States where that particular kind of anthrax is stored.
Yeah, anthrax comes in many, many strains, and of course it's a naturally occurring organism, and it appears under the soil for the most part in many parts of the world, including parts in the United States. Well, in 1981, some cows died of anthrax. They were cows who were in a pasture in Texas. And as is always the case when anthrax or any other kind of exotic organism is discovered to have caused the disease, materials are sent to our laboratories. And in this case, because it was anthrax, this strain of Ames was sent up to our biological research, defense research headquarters in Fort Detrick in Maryland. And they examined this, and for the first time in 1981, identified this as a new strain, a very, very potent strain, very pathologic, very dangerous. But at that time, it was also sent to several other laboratories in the United States and to at least one and probably more overseas. We know that it was sent over to Porton Down in the UK. So the problem really is that we're not even sure to this day exactly how many laboratories received the samples. There were not the kind of records kept then, as we're first beginning to institute now, for when you have a possible biological weapon, biological warfare agent like anthrax or plague or brucellosis or a number of other diseases that are seen as possible diseases that could be used as, in terms of their organisms to be used as biological weapons. This was not a very good record-keeping practice we've had, so we're not sure today who might have received them, which laboratories had them. We certainly know some do. We're not sure if they might have been sent elsewhere and even overseas elsewhere where someone else could have picked it up. We just don't know.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. I have a caller we'll get right to, but again, I'd like to introduce our guest. Leonard Cole is adjunct professor of political science at Rutgers University. He's an expert on bioterrorism. He's written for a number of publications, the Washington Post, LA Times, New York Times, also Scientific American, The Sciences. He's the author of the book, The Anthrax Letters, A Medical Detective Story, which looks at the anthrax scare of fall of 2001. It's published by Joseph Henry Press. Questions are welcome, and we have somebody here ready to go in Urbana on our line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I just have a quick question. I'm sure you'd get to it eventually, but I'd like to hear what your guest has to say about the they're trying to connect Hatfield to working in a lake. And that seems like such a wild stretch. Were you able to find out enough to flesh out just exactly what they were thinking? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Sure. Yeah, Stephen Hatfield, who, as I said, was the only person whose name has surfaced as a person of interest, and that was when Attorney General Ashcroft named him, has been under close surveillance by the FBI for more than a year. Not only the lake that you refer to, or the pond, which was a couple of miles from where he used to live in Frederick, Maryland, but also the forest, the woods, the place where he had lived earlier, have all been scrutinized carefully. The thought was somehow that maybe evidence for work he had done could have been left in the pond of water, and it would have sunk to the bottom. So whether it would have been laboratory machinery or equipment or some other hoped-for piece of evidence that could have been found. So the FBI drained this lake at a cost of $250,000 and ended up finding nothing. I never have had a chance to speak with Hatfield personally. He doesn't speak to anybody now except his lawyers and maybe his one or two closest friends. And I have had the opportunity to speak to one of his friends at length, I mean for hours, a fellow named Pat Clawson, who was also his designated spokesman. And so I got a sense of who this Hatfield was, not only from Clawson, but from others who knew him. He apparently is a quirky kind of person, a guy who was seen as a conservative politically, very patriotic, but also had a checkered past. He was educated, got a medical degree at what was then a medical school in Rhodesia, and now the country is Zimbabwe, spent some time in South Africa, apparently with their security forces. He lied on his resume, saying that he had a PhD in microbiology. In fact, he did have full credits toward the PhD, just didn't have his dissertation completed. But nevertheless, it is known that he stretched the truth here and there. So he's a quirky kind of guy and probably deserved to have some careful scrutiny. Whether he was the actual perpetrator is a big distance from saying that the man should be looked at and examined. So we don't know for sure who the perpetrator was. The FBI now says it doesn't have evidence sufficiently to indict anybody, let alone to bring somebody toward conviction. So that was the story with Hatfield, or to the best of my knowledge. He's out there. He's still a person of interest, but we don't have a handle beyond that. I might say, if I could, that this is one of several really important and fascinating questions, that who did it. But there are a couple of others that, in my judgment, are at least as important as this.
Well, let's talk about those.
Okay. One of them is the public health question. You know, anthrax is so rare that only 18 people were known to have had inhalation anthrax in the whole 20th century, and most of them occurred decades and decades ago. So we have very little of a base of knowledge about this. And you mentioned earlier that 5 people died. Well, there were 11 people who came down with inhalation anthrax. 11 of them got skin anthrax. Skin anthrax is usually curable, not a big problem. Inhalation anthrax is devastating. We used to believe, until the incidents 2 years ago, that if you had inhalation anthrax and you had begun to show symptoms, you were as good as dead, that there was just nothing that could be done for you of consequence, even with antibiotics and the best medical care available. So if there's any good news to have come out of this, is that of the 11 inhalation cases, all of them were seen by doctors after they had serious symptoms. 6 of them did survive. 5 of them, and I've talked to all of the survivors at length, 5 of the 6 survivors, however, are still quite sick. Only one of them is fully recovered and back to work. So it's still a medical mystery. We're trying to learn as time goes on, as we watch and observe the improvement, for the most part, in the 5 people who are still sick. What's going on? Why are they still sick 2 years later? They have no evidence of the disease anymore, and they still have joint pains, memory lapses. Some of it may be psychological, but some of it is surely physical as well. So that's one of the fascinating public health and medical questions about what we do to get treatment to people early enough and what the long-term after effects are.
5 people died of anthrax exposure. It's pretty clear how 3 of those 5 people were exposed. There are, however, again, among the mysteries, there are these 2 cases, a woman named Kathy Nguyen, who worked in a hospital in New York, and a woman named Audley Lundgren, who lived in rural Connecticut, where they can't figure out how it is these women were exposed. At least the last time I looked at the story, this was still considered to be one of the unanswered questions. Do we now, at this point, have any better idea how it is that those 2 women were exposed to anthrax?
Right. Of the 22 people who had been exposed to anthrax and had come down with either the skin or inhalation type, all but these 2 were associated with the mail in some fashion. Either they opened letters that had anthrax in them, or they were postal workers and apparently were exposed from the anthrax that was leaking from letters that were going through the postal system and the postal process. But these 2 women, you're correct, they had no direct involvement with the Postal Service. and no spores were ever found in any of the places that these women frequented, which is really interesting, especially the case of Ottilie Lundgren, who was the last person to contract anthrax and die. That was November 21st. She lived at home most of the time. She was 94 years old, but she was in unusually good health for a 94-year-old. She had actually had a driver's license until a year or so before she died. But she was at home most of the time. For an hour or a week or so, she would go out to the hairdresser. She would go to the library once in a while. She would have a lunch with her friends once in a while, but almost all the time at home. Not a single spore was located, even though the FBI went in very carefully and the public health people went in carefully to examine all of the locations that she had frequented. No spores were found. But she did have an unusual habit. When she opened her mail, and I spent a lot of time with her niece going over her habits, and her niece spent time during the past years with her aunt, Shirley Davis, her niece, explained to me that when her aunt Ottilie would open the mail, if she were going to preserve a letter, she would put it to the side on one part of the table. If she were going to discard it, she tore it in half and then threw it in the wastebasket, which suggests that if there were a few spores from cross-contamination that had been processed on letters that had been processed at any of the anthrax dosed facilities, namely the one in New Jersey or possibly in Washington, that she would have possibly forced a few of those spores up into the air as she tore the letter up, and some of it might have been inhaled, which is the most logical explanation that we can think of for now, that she had unusual susceptibility. So there's good news and there's bad news in all of this. Hmm. We've estimated that in the postal facilities in Washington and in New Jersey, during the one-month period when we didn't know that anthrax was leaking from the letters that were being processed in those facilities, there were perhaps 85 million letters processed at that same time. Many of them surely had have been cross-contaminated. And it is possible that thousands and maybe even millions of letters had some anthrax spores. Well, the good news is that while some of those letters, I am sure, are still around in people's homes, in their kitchen drawer or on a shelf, the number of spores on them would be so minimal they wouldn't cause problems to most people. The bad news is that apparently some people are susceptible even to a very, very small number of spores. And this is probably the case with these two women. And that's the best we can come up with till now.
Of the people who were killed, two of them were postal workers, and a lot of the other people, a substantial number of the other people who came into contact with anthrax were postal workers, and that's the way that the contact occurred, presumably.
Yeah.
And I think that there was some criticism that, particularly if you take a look at the lengths to which the offices there in the Senate and those buildings were decontaminated, that not enough care was taken for the welfare of the postal workers, we didn't go to the same sorts of lengths to try to clean up the sorting centers and the places where the mail would have gone through. We didn't give that the level of attention that we did at the Capitol. And I wonder what you can say about the way, generally speaking, as a public health threat, we responded to this.
In hindsight, when we look at it, we responded very, very badly. But if you want to be fair, as the incidents unfolded, given the lack of knowledge and the lack of precedence of finding anthrax in the mail, this was a learning experience from the beginning. Now, one could say the Postal Service, the FBI, other law enforcement people, public health people, should have been more aggressive early on. That the moment there was a suspicion that anthrax was in the mail anyplace, that wherever that mail might have passed through, you close it up, and you do some testing immediately. But we didn't have that sense of knowledge. We just didn't know that anthrax could leak through letters. One of the discoveries afterwards is that apparently the anthrax bugs were coming through the letters in the postal buildings during those weeks when everyone would have thought that even if there were anthrax letters going through those facilities, the anthrax would have been contained within those envelopes and wouldn't have been a threat until the envelopes were actually opened. in truth, it turns out, and we learn in hindsight, that this anthrax spore, an individual spore, is perhaps 1, 2, or 3 microns in size. But the envelope paper has pores as large as 20 microns, so that these little spores were working their way through and they were leaking. But we didn't know that. In the case of the Senate exposure, that was on a Monday morning, October 15th, when an intern in Senator Daschle's office opened this letter, and it had a threat saying there's anthrax here, and this powder wafted out, and it was soon found that this really was anthrax. So a great deal of attention was focused immediately on all of the people who were in that location, the vicinity of the letter, in Senator Daschle's office, and a whole bunch of them, dozens and dozens of them, were treated immediately with Cipro, an antibiotic, and were told to wash carefully, and they were observed carefully. And so that, yes, it's certainly true that they got very quick treatment early on. But by the time that these people had been found to have been exposed, it was not clear, even at that point, that there was a danger from the Daschle letter before it had been opened in Daschle's office. So it was a wrong assumption. It turns out to have been a terribly wrong assumption and caused some deaths. But no one knew, no one, to the best of my knowledge, had an inkling. And probably even the sender of the letter, the perpetrator, may not have realized that the anthrax was posed a danger just by leaking through sealed letters as well and had contaminated the Postal Service.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not clear whether, given the knowledge at that time, how much sooner, maybe a day or two sooner, in reacting to the postal facility in Washington would have been legitimate to have expected. But it wasn't that there were two classes of people, the people in Daschle's office and then the people in the Postal Service, who were seen as one of them more worthy of early treatment and the other less worthy of treatment.
Yeah, you talked about the fact earlier that there are certainly a lot of unanswered questions about this, and we have talked about a couple of them. We've spent quite a bit of time talking about the question of who might be responsible. We touched briefly on the question of the long-term health of the people who were exposed and what the exposure means for them. Let me ask you just about one third area. Again, it's a very big one, but that's the question, are we any better prepared to deal with something like this today than we were in the fall of 2001?
That's the premier question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That's something that can make all the difference in whether we're going to see casualties, perhaps many deaths, if there were to be a replay of this. And I have to give a cop-out answer. The answer is yes and no. We are surely better prepared on many levels. I would say that on two levels in particular. One, having gone through this experience, you can be sure that postal authorities, law enforcement authorities, would be prepared to act much more quickly if there was the slightest evidence of anthrax. In fact, just a few weeks ago, there was an initial test in Washington at an Anacostia postal facility, it was called, that there was a confirmation of anthrax in the building. Well, that place was closed immediately, and 10 other postal facilities were also closed immediately that were downstream that would have received letters from this facility. It turned out 24 hours later, with additional testing, that this was a false positive test. So yes, there would be a much quicker reaction. Furthermore, the medical community in general, public health people, and medical doctors across the country, and others who work in medical facilities, are much more aware of the possibility of bioterrorism and the kind of materials, including anthrax, that could be used. And could be plague bacteria, could be botulinum, or even Ebola. They've now become more familiar with this. There have been many more education courses to familiarize people with the possibility of these exotic organisms being around, what kind of symptoms they cause. So we're better off there. And on another level, we're better off because a great deal more money is going into research to bioterrorism-related issues. And that involves a quicker detection means, more accurate detection, improved vaccination, improved antibiotic responses. We're just learning more and devoting more to studying bioterrorism questions. But the no part in terms of why aren't we better prepared is that under some conditions, for sure, we are still very vulnerable. And actually, there's no such thing as a 100% foolproof protection. But if somebody got a dose of the powder, anthrax, or some other kind of exotic organism that could be dangerous into the ventilation system of a building, well, that could be very dangerous. And furthermore, we saw that just a half dozen or seven or maybe even eight letters caused the Capitol to be closed down, the Senate and House office buildings to be closed, and during the following weeks, the Supreme Court was evacuated. It caused deaths down in Florida up to Connecticut, and that was just from the small number of letters. Imagine if there were 500 or 600 letters instead of five or six letters. It could be much more devastating. But, again, we're much more aware and prepared to deal with this in a way that wasn't the case a couple of years ago.
Well, I think that we're going to have to leave it at that because we've come to the end of our time. I want to mention once again, if you'd like to read more on the subject, you can look for the book that we have been talking about here. It's titled The Anthrax Letters, A Medical Detective Story, published by Joseph Henry Press, by our guest, Leonard Cole. He is adjunct professor of political science at Rutgers University in Newark, New Jersey, and is an expert on bioterrorism. And Professor Cole, thank you very much for giving us your time today.
Well, I very much appreciate it, and I just want to say one final word, that the reading of the story itself is quite thrilling, and I dedicate this in my own mind now to the people who were able to survive and, unfortunately, those who didn't.
All right. Very good. Well, again, thanks.
Thank you.